What if wisdom wasn't found in lecture halls, but on trains? Eric Weiner discovered this unlikely truth while traveling across continents, seeking not destinations, but philosophers. 14 of history's greatest thinkers who wrestled with one question: how should we live? This isn't your typical philosophy book filled with dense arguments and footnotes. Instead, it's a journey where ancient wisdom meets modern restlessness, where Socrates rides shotgun and Thoreau peers out the window. The genius lies in recognizing that philosophy was never meant to gather dust on shelves. It's practical medicine for the soul, offering remedies for our daily struggles with meaning, mortality, and morning alarms. Philosophy isn't about winning arguments, but living better lives. It's the practical skill of navigating life's complexities with grace and integrity. These philosophers weren't ivory tower intellectuals, but practical guides wrestling with the same questions we face today. Their wisdom isn't found in abstract theorizing, but in embodied practice, in how we see, how we listen, how we fight, how we age, how we die. We look at thousands of things daily, yet see almost nothing. Henry David Thoreau understood this paradox. For him, seeing wasn't passive, but active conversation with the world. While most hastily categorize observations, Thoreau lingered between hypothesis and conclusion, creating space for genuine perception. His vision was necessarily subjective and emotional. He couldn't merely observe a landscape, he felt it. This required physical engagement, walking through Concord, building his cabin, swimming in Walden Pond. These weren't leisure, but essential practices for developing sight. Simone Weil demanded something radical: pay attention. Her conception of attention wasn't merely cognitive, but a moral virtue equivalent to courage or justice. True attention differs fundamentally from concentration. Concentration constricts and tires, while attention expands and rejuvenates. It requires negative effort, a state of waiting rather than seeking. Only by giving someone our full attention with no expectation of reward are we engaged in this rarest and purest form of generosity. Even giving time without attention is the cruelest fraud. In our age of notifications and multitasking, this call to pure attention becomes revolutionary. Arthur Schopenhauer built his philosophy around perpetual dissatisfaction. Beneath reality lies the will, a purposeless force generating endless desires. Satisfy one craving and another immediately appears. His bleak outlook mirrored his life. His mother tired of him, his father constantly criticized, and recognition came only in old age. Yet he discovered one escape: music. Unlike other arts depicting mere shadows, music expresses the innermost nature of all life and existence. This explains music's power to pierce through depression and show measurable healing effects in stroke patients. His pessimism offers strange comfort in our age of toxic positivity. Perhaps contentment begins with accepting that perfect happiness is impossible, finding instead moments of respite amid inevitable struggles. Seishonagon offers a complementary philosophy of beautiful small things. This Japanese court lady created the pillow book nearly 1,000 years ago, cataloging life's subtle pleasures. Shaved ice with sweet syrup in a shiny new metal bowl, a crystal rosary, wisteria flowers, snow on plum blossoms. Her love of cherry blossoms reflects the Buddhist concept of impermanence. The Japanese celebrate life's ephemeral nature rather than fear it. Cherry blossoms are beautiful not despite their brief blooming, but because of it. Beauty lies in its own vanishing. Marcus Aurelius commanded 500,000 men, yet struggled with mornings. This great bed question tests philosophy's worth. If it can't get us out of bed, what good is it? His meditations reveals his daily wrestling. At dawn, when you have trouble getting out of bed, tell yourself, "I have to go to work," as a human being. Not as emperor or stoic, but as human. This distinction between duty, internal, and obligation, external, unlocks motivation. We rise not because others expect it, but because our humanity demands it. Marcus acknowledged the difficulty while maintaining perspective. Yes, the warm bed feels wonderful. Yes, challenges await, but we're part of something larger, requiring our participation. By framing rising as service to our humanity rather than submission to demands, Marcus transforms reluctance into purpose. Philosophy isn't about grand gestures, but daily choices. The most profound test isn't answering abstract questions, but living with integrity through mundane challenges. Gandhi reimagined conflict as constructive engagement, like a soccer match, ending in a tie but leaving the field greener. Despite his small frame, he possessed steel strength of body and will. He transformed ancient Jain nonviolence into a universal weapon to fight oppression, coining Satyagraha, truth force. The Satyagrahi suffers voluntarily to change hearts, willing to die but never kill. Gandhi insisted means and ends are inseparable. Impure means result in impure ends. During the 1930 Salt March, followers endured brutal police beatings without resistance. Though change wasn't immediate, Britain lost both moral authority and appetite for violence. This philosophy inspired Martin Luther King Jr.'s stern love and applies to everyday disputes. Examine your position, recognize you hold only partial truth, and view your partner as opponent, not enemy. The goal isn't condemnation, but conversion through gentle persuasion, seeing people as they could become. Despite chronic illness and poor book sales, Nietzsche remained prolific, wandering between Switzerland and southern France. During a walk along Lake Silvaplana, his Thought of Thoughts struck, eternal recurrence of the same. We must live our exact lives infinitely, every joy, pain, and mundane moment repeating endlessly. Unlike reincarnation, we return as ourselves with no memory of previous iterations. Eternal recurrence is an existential stress test. Would you relive your entire life exactly as it happened? Despite his troubles, Nietzsche declared himself grateful, adding, "Da capo," again. He saw suffering as essential for growth. Success means radical acceptance of fate, like Sisyphus finding happiness in his eternal boulder pushing. Eternal recurrence challenges us to find joy not in certainty, but its opposite. If we live the same life repeatedly without change, what can we do but laugh, or better yet, dance? When your time is up, shout, "Da capo," again, again. Thoreau teaches attentive observation, lingering between hypothesis and conclusion, noticing dew-covered spiderwebs and subtle shifts in morning light. This seeing is ethical, recognizing our interconnection with everything. Simone Weil shows that true attention means asking, "What are you going through?" acknowledging others' full humanity. Schopenhauer reveals music as escape from endless wanting, while Seishonagon reminds us life exists in details: the perfect coffee cup, rain on windows, unexpected kindness. Marcus Aurelius insists rising with purpose is philosophy's daily test. Gandhi demonstrates that how we fight matters more than what we're fighting for. Conversion through gentle persuasion, not condemnation. Nietzsche urges complete life affirmation, saying yes even to suffering. We're all passengers on a train, unable to control the track, but able to choose our experience. We can stare anxiously at our watches or appreciate the passing landscape. Life is neither good nor evil. It's the scene of good or evil, as you make it. Through philosophical practice, we learn not just to endure this journey, but to embrace it, perhaps even to dance through it with joyful affirmation, ready at the end to shout, "Da capo," again, again.